I am pleased to introduce right now the Honorable Gareth Evans, co-chair of the International Commission on Nuclear Nonproliferation. Many other esteemed titles he has I could go into, but most importantly, 2 hours ago, just became a grandfather for the third time to a beautiful little Zachary Elijah.
Which is really, at the end of the day, what all this stuff is about. Future generations, our kids, their kids, making the world safer and saner for them. Thanks, Rihanna, for that introduction. Thanks, John, for describing the way in which I've been turning up like a bad penny on so many of these occasions over so many years, always with an axe to grind about something or other, but hopefully in a worthwhile cause. And thanks to MPI, thanks to GSI and everybody associated with the Middle Powers Initiative for bringing us together on this extremely important and timely occasion. This report, well, I know what some of you are probably thinking. Another day, another international panel of the great and the good, another big fat report. Well, so what? We've been there, we've done that. Henrik Salander had been here, I think he'd be thinking, well, we did, after all, do the Blix Commission report not so long ago. What's the value added by an enterprise of this kind? What's the point of spending as much time and energy as we did to produce this over the last year? I think several things, and I can retail them very briefly. The first is the timeliness of the enterprise. As Rihanna has said in introduction, as so many of us are acutely aware, this is an opportune moment. Whereas for so many years, including with the Canberra Commission, with the Blix Commission, we were all, in a sense, resisting the tide, trying desperately to gain traction, foothold, attention somewhere, somehow, for the principles that we hold dear. Nobody very much was listening, but people are now listening. We are riding something of a wave. The opportunity is there. With the Obama administration, with the response to the Obama administration internationally, and a report which does more than simply make the case for doing something, but tries in a great deal of detail to spell out how this whole enterprise can be systematically advanced, does, I think, have a utility simply because it's riding the wave rather than resisting the tide. The second utility of the report, I think, is its comprehensiveness. It's very fat and very full on all three of the crucial issues of disarmament, non-proliferation, and peaceful uses that are inextricably tangled together as we try and move this agenda forward. If you think back on all the previous reports, as good, as compelling, as important as most of them have been, each one of them have tended to focus on just one or two of those areas and not really go into the necessary degree of detail about all of them and about the interaction between them. And I think you'll find this report does just that. And in language and with an approach to the gathering and compiling of data, which makes it, I hope, a pretty useful handbook or reference book for all those policymakers around the place who are wrestling with this issue, and many, many governments, many of whom, of course, don't have the background of years and years of intense engagement with the high-level technical issues that are the meat and drink for so many of you here. And I think in that context, the comprehensiveness and the way this stuff is put together will be of some real utility. The third important thing about the report, which does, I think, add value to it, is the representative character of the commission and the consultative process that we went through in compiling the report. The commission itself was not chosen as a kind of choir to sing to a pre-established hymn book of well-established lines and notes and only being a matter of drawing it out and writing it out. We put deliberately on the commission a whole bunch of people who we knew would be hard to convince. Klaus Naumann, the German former Chief of General Staff and head of the NATO Military Commission, who has recently, as a couple of years ago, been writing stuff to suggest that the nuclear option needed to be retained to deal with a whole variety of NATO non-nuclear security contingencies. We had Brajesh Mishra, the father of the Indian bomb, on our commission. And with due respect to Thomas Oburu Osaki, we had a Japanese co-chair and Japanese co-production of this whole commission report in an environment where Japan needed to be persuaded, Japanese policymakers needed to be persuaded about some of the very core arguments that have emerged from the commission report about reducing the salience of nuclear weapons, particularly again in non-nuclear threat contingency environments. So to produce a unanimous report from a commission as varied as this one was is, I think, testimony to the effort that went into ensuring that the inputs were genuinely representative and that we went through a worldwide process of consultations in Latin America, in South Asia, in Northeast Asia, in the Middle East, gathering together large numbers of people and, of course, worked with research institutions and associates in many, many countries as well. So the whole thing, even though it sounds like an Australia, Japan, Asia regional enterprise, was really a genuinely global one. And the report, I think, is the most genuinely globally representative of its kind to be produced. And the fourth and final thing I'd say about the report in terms of the value added is that it is very, very self-consciously, hard-headed, pragmatic, realistic in the way in which it approaches these issues. It's not just a wish list of what we would like to see happen. It's a very hard-edged, thanks very much, appreciation of all the innumerable constraints that exist out there as we try to make it happen. Because we knew the constituency that we were primarily addressing with this report was not that of the true believers, but rather that of the unbelievers or the skeptics or the plain simply ignorant in government policy-making institutions all around the world who really needed to be persuaded and needed to have their instincts about the difficulty of all of this stuff properly acknowledged and attended to in the way in which the argument was put together. So on things like the probability of a proliferation surge in the Middle East if Iran in particular should go nuclear, on the particular question of de-alerting and the possibility of moving very quickly to achieve something that we would all want to see happen, on the question of the ease with which terrorists could produce a nuclear bomb as distinct from a dirty bomb just using radionuclides, on the question of how easy it will be or how confident we can be about moving on a path directly and systematically to zero as distinct from having way stations along the way with a minimization objective en route rather than a very clearly defined date for zero. On the issue of how the whole concept of a nuclear weapons convention could be used as a campaign vehicle for getting where all those of us in this room want to get. On all these and on many, many other issues, you'll find this report taking positions which are not going, I know, to endear ourselves completely to NGO and many other constituencies around the place who like this stuff much more fiercely and unreservedly asserted. What we've done, I think, is have a very clear concept of where we want to go, where we must go, where the world must go, but accompanied it by a very comprehensive set of analyses of just how difficult that's going to be to constitute a kind of reality check. And to make it clear to governmental decision makers that we're not simply ignoring the constraints that they overwhelmingly feel as they go about their business. But having said all that, and having emphasized the realism and pragmatism, the tedious realism and pragmatism in some ways of the report, as well as its comprehensiveness and all those other things, I do want to make it clear that the basic themes of the report do come through, I hope, very loudly and clearly. For all the caution that is acknowledged to be necessary, the basic lines are very, very clear indeed. Line number one, it's sheer dumb luck. Nothing more, nothing less than sheer dumb luck that we've got to where we are in 2010 without a major nuclear catastrophe, without a major nuclear explosion in a population center. It's not a product of good management. It's not a product of good policy. It's a matter of sheer dumb luck. And if you look at Jonathan Granoff's recent article in the World Policy Institute, which I think was circulated to participants in this meeting, you'll find an even more comprehensive laying out of some of the reasons we say just that. I mean, I think the example Jonathan used, which we didn't use in the report, but is really the most graphic of all, dates back to the Carter years, 1979, when Chuck Percy was visiting a defence installation, and it just so happened that a few minutes later, the defence establishment's screens lit up with the information that 200 Soviet missiles were on their way to United States targets. And a few minutes later, I think it was 1,200 or 2,000 missiles that were on their way, which concentrated fairly comprehensively the minds of the military and other decision makers involved until it was recognized. And it took some minutes for this to happen. That what had occurred was a technician, in order to demonstrate to Senator Chuck Percy the brilliance of the arrangements in place to deal with any such attack, had fed a demonstration tape, a training tape, into the wrong computer. And as a result, I mean, we were that close to generating a major response. Bill Perry told the commission similar stories of his days as a senior defence technical official, being woken at 3 o'clock in the morning to be told that their computers were showing 200 missiles coming in. "We think," they said, "it's a computer chip malfunction because we're not getting this from our other collateral sources. But for Christ's sake, can you come in fast and tell us what the hell is going on so we can make a decision about how to respond to this?" Over and over and over again, there are examples of this kind which demonstrate that through technical malfunction or with the potential for human error, we've been, even with the very sophisticated command and control arrangements that have basically existed through the Cold War years between the two major superpowers, we've been that close just so often to the balloon going up in an extremely comprehensively cataclysmic way. And in the present environment, with countries like Pakistan and India now in the game with, I can tell you, much less sophisticated command and control arrangements than those that existed during the Cold War years, and the potential for even more coming into the game in the future, this is a serious problem. Add to that the growing sophistication and capacity for cyber warfare, for electronic misinformation to be communicated, and you can see for yourselves, and everybody I think can see for yourselves, what the nature of the problem is. So our report is very, very clear about all this stuff. Secondly, we're very, very clear that the scale of the threat that is involved for the world, when you add up the existing stockpiles of nuclear weapons, the risk of proliferation, the risk such as is of nuclear terrorism, and the risks associated with an expansion of civil nuclear energy, in particular if there's enrichment and reprocessing in new countries associated with that. When you add up all those risks, you're talking about a risk out there which is on a scale absolutely commensurate with that of the worst climate change scenarios, because you're talking about something which is potentially quite catastrophic for life on this planet as we know it. And that theme comes very, very clearly through the report. And so too does the third basic theme of the report, which is that the only solution at the end of the day for these concerns and anxieties is a world absolutely without nuclear weapons. And in that context, we do pick up the central mantra of the Canberra Commission back in 96, which in a nutshell, I think, you know, puts the argument as well as it can be put. Namely, so long as any country has nuclear weapons, others will want them. So long as any country has nuclear weapons, they're bound one day to be used by accident or miscalculation, if not by deliberate design, and any such use would be catastrophic. So let no one be in any doubt about the basic thinking which lies behind this Commission's report and the basic principles which energise its conclusions. The analysis and the recommendations in the report are built around and ultimately come together in the form of a series of action plans for the short, medium, and long term. And I think, again, this is one of the real utilities of this report, that it doesn't just state a whole bunch of different worthwhile objectives in a sort of ad hoc fashion all over the landscape, but brings it together systematically in terms of timelines and in terms of grouping the issues. So very, very briefly, in the time available to me, I'll just sketch out the way in which we've brought these issues together so you can see what the scope of the report is and what some of its primary substance is. The short, medium, and long-term action agendas are, as we identify them, as follows. The short term is through to 2012, not entirely coincidentally coinciding with what up until last night we've been inclined to refer to as the first term of the Obama administration. Let's hope it's that. And the term of the current Medvedev administration in Russia as being an ideal time to take stock of what we've been able to achieve. And in that short-term period between now and 2012, the medium term goes through to 2025, the longer term is beyond that. But in the short term, the next three and a bit years to the end of 2012, what is it that we should be trying to achieve? Well, basically in three tranches, building blocks that are relevant both to non-proliferation and disarmament, non-proliferation measures and disarmament measures. The building blocks are obviously CTBT, obviously fissile material cutoff treaty, with all the angst that that continues to give us with the latest news coming out of Geneva about Pakistani recalcitrance yet again for even a basic work program, with unfortunately, as we know, probably several countries sheltering behind that intransigence. And also the issue of the security issues, which are going to be comprehensively dealt with at the Obama summit in April. There's that agenda. The non-proliferation agenda involves obviously making the greatest possible success we can of the NPT review conference, and also crucially resolving or at least containing the Iran and DPRK breakout problems. When it comes to the NPT review conference, I think, and this will be the main theme of the next couple of days, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, you'll have ample opportunity to do that. But I think it's crucial, and delighted that we've got Libran Kabaktalan and Boniface with us and other crucial players in the NPT review process. It's critical that all of us involved in this keep a very keen sense of priorities. There's literally hundreds of proposals out there. There are multiple hundreds of working papers and other propositions, and an enormous number of people have got an enormous number of axes to grind and push, and most of the proposals that are up are worthwhile. But basically, the success or failure of the NPT is going to depend on three groups of issues being resolved. First of all, coming up with some strong and sensible agreements on strengthening the NPT regime in all the way that we all know around this table, these tables, needs to be strengthened. When it comes to verification, compliance, enforcement, strengthening the IAEA, that whole litany of measures, very well articulated in Security Council Resolution 1887, that must be on the agenda, and we do have to get delivery of that. But secondly, and equally crucially, there's got to be some major delivery on the disarmament front. The classic Article 6 anxiety has to be met by the nuclear armed states agreeing to some updated variation of the 13 practical steps of 2000. One of the things we've tried to do in this report is re-articulate that disarmament statement in contemporary guise, retaining all that was so painfully negotiated in 2000, all that's worth preserving, but adding some more to it will, hopefully, as a negotiating text. But unless we do that with the NPT review conference, get some serious movement and serious commitment again from the nuclear arms states, the nuclear weapon states, I think we can forget about creating the environment we need to get major movement on strengthening the NPT part of the equation. The third issue is, of course, the old chestnut of the Middle East, which is troubling the way in which it keeps on intruding and does seem to many people to be a bit of a sideshow and ought not to occupy the prominence that it does. But the truth of the matter is this is all part of the negotiating history of 1994. Some way of advancing the commitment to nuclear weapons-free zone, weapons of mass destruction-free zone in the Middle East. One of the useful things I think my commission did during the course of its preparation was to convene a meeting in Cairo of all the key Middle East players, including as well as the Egyptians and the North Africans and the other Arab League countries, both Iran and Israel. And coming out of that meeting was at least, I think, the beginnings of a consensus that maybe, just maybe, there would be a case for the Secretary General, UN Secretary General, convening a meeting on the whole question of a WMD-free zone for the Middle East within a year or so, at which we couldn't contemplate any negotiations taking place. That's far too premature. But at least systematic consideration of what the preconditions for such a zone might be, what the prerequisites for it might be, and that might just get buy-in from all the relevant countries. If we can get something like that coming out of the NPT review process, agreement on that out of the RevCon, then I think that may be enough to diffuse that issue and give it some general, genuine weight and substance going forward. But the important point I'm wanting to make is, though there are many, many other issues, security-related issues, Obama summit-related issues and so on, that will undoubtedly capture time and attention, and properly so, with the review conference, getting right a big package of measures on strengthening the NPT regime itself, getting right a big statement on disarmament, and getting right something on the Middle East is the preconditions for success there. All of this is still in the short-term framework. The other things we're saying, apart from the NPT review conference and the building block issues, are the absolute need, quite separately, to get some movement on the disarmament front, not only in the form of a statement at the NPT review conference, but to get some real runs on the board. The US-Russia bilateral deal in this respect is incredibly important. We're all hoping that could be wrapped up before the end of last year. It hasn't been. One of the reasons Rose Gottmuller is not here, as was anticipated at this conference, I understand, is she's flying back to Moscow for yet another attempt to try and resolve this by the end of this month. That's absolutely crucial. But not only that, so too is the continuation of that into further stages of further deep reductions. At best, we're going to get out of this current start follow-on process an agreement to reduce to something like So within the period to 2012, we want to see not only this treaty wrapped up, but major, major progress made on the successors to it. Equally, some serious start being made on multilateralization of an arms control disarmament process. I think it would be very quixotic indeed to imagine any serious movement, buy-in, agreement by the other nuclear armed states within that time frame to actually reducing their arsenals, but it is a reasonable aspiration to try and get them signed up to a proposition they at least hold the line against any further increases, thus making possible some systematic stepping back over the decade beyond that. So laying the foundations through strategic dialogue, through studies, through perhaps the beginnings of some kind of process of discussion in a Geneva environment on the multilateral front is also important, as is the major bilateral issue in the period to 2012, but probably the most important, not the most important of all, but extremely important, is within that early time frame, getting some major movement on the question of nuclear doctrine, the role, the salience of nuclear weapons. I can think of no more important issue on the world's agenda right now, January 2010, than getting a positive outcome from the US Nuclear Posture Review on the question of doctrine, what nuclear weapons are actually for. This is the one area in the Prague speech where Barack Obama was cautious, used generalized language about reducing the role of the salience of nuclear weapons, but certainly didn't make any explicit commitments. This is an area where we know that the internal processes of the US system have been much engaged for the last few months, and we know that everybody understands how significant this is. But it seems to me, and I think probably to many people in this room, that unless we get from that nuclear posture review process, quite apart from cautiously written stuff about modernization and so on, which doesn't frighten horses elsewhere, unless we get from that nuclear posture process a very clear commitment by the US to reducing the role, the salience of nuclear weapons, not through a no first use doctrinal commitment, that's a little bit too much to bite off at this early stage, but certainly through a statement that the sole purpose of nuclear weapons is to, so long as they exist, is to deter their use by others against oneself or one's allies. That is a realistic target to aim for. It's something that's very much in the mind of senior figures in this administration, starting, I know, with the president himself. And I believe it's absolutely crucial to deliver on that. And to deliver on that will be the best possible news, I think, for the NPT process and review conference process. Not to deliver on it is going to make life, frankly, that much harder. It's not necessarily a complete showstopper, but sure as hell is going to make life difficult, because out there, the believers in nuclear apartheid, the believers that the existing nuclear armed states are simply not going to ever take seriously their NPT obligations if they're members of the NPT, or to move to zero if they're not, that belief is alive and well, and it's colouring every other aspect of the agenda, as most people in this room acutely know. So that issue is absolutely crucial. I, for one, would love to see doctrinal issues being advanced on a much broader front than just the US itself, as the Chinese already have with no first use, as the Indians to some extent already have, but to get that from the other players in this game is not going to be easy at this stage. Getting it from the United States would be fantastically important. So that's the short-term agenda, and it's a hell of a big agenda, but it's important that we get movement, I think, on all those fronts. The medium-term agenda, as we've articulated, goes through to 2025, and that basically is for there to be achieved by that date what we call the minimization point, the minimization target, comparable to what the Four Horsemen referred to as the base camp, or referred to as the way station, the vantage point. But what it really means is to recognise that getting to zero within that time frame is going to be god-awfully difficult, but getting to a minimisation point characterised by the following three things may not be that impossible at all, if we can summon the will and particularly generate some momentum in this period immediately ahead. The three elements of the minimisation point are numbers, doctrine and deployment. And the numbers, what we're talking about and argue for very clearly in this report, is a 90% reduction in the number of warheads that are out there, from something like 23,000 at the moment to a maximum of 2,000, 500 each for the US and Russia, down from 13,000 and 9,000 each respectively, 1,000 for everybody else. Some people have criticised us already for that, saying it's not ambitious enough, but frankly, given what we know to be the scale of the constraints out there, the attitudes out there, if we can get to those numbers, we can get to 10% of what we have at the moment. That'd be a fantastically important achievement, and it is doable. What we're talking about is not just deployed warheads or not strategic warheads, we're talking about everything. A nuke is a nuke is a nuke. We've got to get that mindset into our negotiators and get results accordingly, which means the actual destruction of all those numbers in excess of the numbers that I've mentioned. The doctrinal issue is to get everybody signed up and meaning a no first use commitment by 2025 at the absolute latest, but starting much, much earlier than that, including hopefully, as I've said, particularly in the context of the US, right now, and certainly before 2012. When it comes to deployment, that's also critical, because unless you have the real world allocation of weapons reflecting an, in practice, a no first use commitment, and not being sort of placed against that in terms of having a massive number of weapons available and actively deployed on high notice, high alert status, what you have to have is the minimum number of weapons on submarines or whatever for survivability purpose, but the rest of them basically locked away, dismantled, or at least disassembled, not available for ready use, and certainly with long lead terms, long decision times in terms of their actual usability. So if you've got that combination of low numbers, doctrine as to the use of these things, and deployment which is consistent with and reinforces that doctrine, the world, we argue in this report, would be a hell of a lot safer than it is at the moment, and it's a highly worthwhile objective. Of course, that's not the end of the story. In the third phase, the longer term, beyond 2025, is moving from the minimisation point to actual zero. And this is absolutely critical. We weren't able as a commission to persuade ourselves that we could come up with a credible date certain for getting to zero. The issues, of verification, the issues of enforcement, the psychological issues involved in countries giving up their last weapon, the basic geopolitical issues and ensuring that there's sufficient stability in the regional areas of great volatility at the moment, and with the tectonic plates that are shifting globally, all those things are going to make life god-awfully difficult in moving from those low numbers, which we think are readily achievable, to the zero numbers, which are going to be much, much tougher. And we can't put a date on it, but we do think with enough momentum building up, this is something that is achievable. And what we do, however, emphasise in all of this, and we're a bit tougher in this respect than the Gang of Four were, who talked about the mountaintop being shrouded in mist at that stage and the critical thing being just to get to the base camp and to sort of, you know, take pause and take stock of where we are then. What we're saying in this report very clearly is that this can't just be a mountaintop shrouded in mist. It has to be a mountaintop which is a beacon in the sunlight, where we can see what the path actually is up to the summit to get to that zero. Because going back to where I began, without that commitment to zero, frankly, we're never going to be confident that we've made the world as safe as it has to be against these impossibly, indiscriminately inhumane weapons. The very final thing that this report does is pay pretty close attention to the politics of getting from here to there, not only in terms of trying to articulate the issues in programmatic terms and the way I've sketched out with timelines and sequences and interrelationships, but also by drawing attention to what the political preconditions are going to be. And what we said is basically political will is, as always, the crucial issue, but you can't just lament the absence of political will. That's a given in any form of international or domestic discourse. It's never going to be there when you want it. You've got to create it. You've got to create it through leadership. You've got to create it through building knowledge and understanding of the issues and the relevant constituencies. You've got to create it through identifying strategies that are actually capable of moving the game forward. And you've got to create that political will through a whole variety of processes, institution building of one kind or another, other processes, which will actually feed into and advance those strategies. Political will is a very complicated business, and it involves commitment and input at three basically different levels: top-down leadership, peer group pressure sideways, bottom-up leadership. And in a nuclear context, you know what that means. Top-down leadership means Russia, China. It means the big guys, the nuclear haves in the first instance, getting serious, staying serious. Peer group pressure means exactly what the MPI is all about, what the New Agenda Coalition was all about, what so much of the energy that's going into these NPT and other review processes is all about. Recognising that out there in the international community is a vast constituency of well-intentioned, civilised countries that do want to move forward on these issues, but which have to be mobilised, harnessed their commitment, their engagement, and pushed and pointed in the right direction and given the ammunition with which to work. And the third element is, of course, the bottom-up civil society energising of those constituencies whose business in life is to keep governments honest, to keep governments and intergovernmental organisations energised. With the NPI process, you've got the ideal mix and marriage of the bottom-up civil society process with major, major NGOs involved, plus the target audience of key middle power countries that are actually capable of moving this game forward. So I think it's a fantastically important enterprise for the middle powers and all those supporting that enterprise to get together on occasions like this, to think through the issues, to focus not on the vast spread of things we can all talk about on these occasions, but the very specific priorities that are needed to energise the debate here and now in the various relevant places and to move the game forward. My last word on this subject is that really this is a fantastically opportune moment. The time is better now than it's been for the last 10 years where the international community has been sleepwalking. The potential is there to grab this issue by the scruff and to take it forward. And if we don't, and if we live long enough between us to lament it, we're going to lament for a very long time that we haven't grabbed this opportunity. So I do urge you to, using this and any other resources that you have, to pick up that ball and run now very, very hard with it over the next few months. This is a crucial time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, lest I got everybody to accept.